This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Arizona passed a law this month that made it the first state of the nation to mandate high school students pass a test in civics. We've been hearing about the decline of civics education for years, and one issue keeps arising. Is it possible to keep politics out of civics? For that matter, is keeping politics out of the classroom a good idea at all?
The teachers who were doing, in our minds, really good work had to work very, very hard to make sure that students were hearing multiple and alternative points of view.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the authors of the book, The Political Classroom, about how keeping politics in the classroom can go a long way towards teaching students how to participate in civics discussions and political life. And we'll spend an academic minute with a very current topic of political debate, presidential executive orders. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Civics education without controversial issues is like a symphony without sound. Diana Hess wrote that in her award-winning 2009 book, Controversy in the Classroom, The Democratic Power of Discussion. Helping students develop their ability to deliberate political questions can be an essential component of a young person's education. But introducing political issues into the classroom is challenging at best and can raise ethical dilemmas for teachers. Now, Dr. Hess has collaborated with another award-winning author and educator, Paula McAvoy, on a book that shows how civics and political discussion is actually being taught in schools. The name of their book is The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. Dr. Diana Hess is a professor of curriculum and instruction at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and senior vice president of the Spencer Foundation. And Dr. Paula McAvoy is a philosopher of education and assistant program officer of the Spencer Foundation. It's a foundation which investigates ways to improve education around the world. I spoke to both authors about this book and started by asking Dr. Hess if there has ever been a time when bringing up politics in the classroom has not been a hornet's nest.
The answer is both yes and no. So the yes is that clearly whenever schools become a place where students are talking about authentic political controversies, they're are some people who will get upset by that. On the other hand, when we look at the history of American civic education, back in the 20s and 30s, lots and lots of students took a class called American Problems. And in the American Problems class, students routinely talked about the issues of the day. So one thing that's ironic is that today, we don't have such classes. You know, we have lots of civic education classes, but they don't all focus on the contemporary issues of the day. And what we're encouraging teachers to do and what we're encouraging parents and the public to support is including these kinds of issues in civic education or social studies classes.
You divided your book into three parts. Let's talk about those. First, the context, evidence, and aims. What were you getting at there?
So one thing we found when we studied high school classrooms in which teachers do a lot of political controversy in the classroom is that the context matters. And so we begin the first part of the book by placing the study that undergirds this book in its political context and talk about how challenging it is to talk about politics when our society is so partisan and divided right now. On top of that, we have income inequality, we have highly segregated schools, and so all of these things make the context of teaching about political controversy challenging. The evidence part is that the book is based on a study of 35 classroom teachers, all high school teachers, in 21 schools in three different states. And we talk about what we found when we studied teachers who do this really well and compared them to teachers who primarily use lecture in the classroom. And we then followed students throughout their course and then 2 and 4 years after their courses to see if talking about controversial political issues helped them become more informed and engaged citizens. And then the evidence part is that when we were talking to teachers and students about their classroom practice, we found that there were ethical challenges to doing this type of work. Whether, for example, should a teacher share their political views with the class was an issue that lots of teachers face when they bring political controversy into the classroom. So the first part of the book sort of lays out the context of the study, the findings from the study, and then the ethical challenges that we found.
Let me just ask you about those 35. Where did you find the people that you studied?
So we found the teachers by working with some democratic education organizations that had programs designed to help young people learn how to talk about these issues. So one of those organizations was Choices for the 21st Century, which is at Brown University, and another organization is the Constitutional Rights Foundation, which is here in Chicago. And through those two organizations, we found a lot of teachers in these three states, Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin, who were doing this kind of teaching. And then in their same schools, we looked for teachers who weren't doing this kind of teaching so we could get the comparison. And then after a year of doing the study, we branched out and looked for teachers who were not part of either one of those programs, but were designing some of their own curriculum to be used. So we have teachers who are in urban schools and suburban schools and rural schools, in public schools and private schools, in schools that are religiously affiliated and those that are not. So we really have a wide variety of schools, and in those schools we had over 1,000 students. So we think we have a pretty good sample from which to understand what happens when this is done well compared to what happens when it's not done at all.
So from that large a pool to draw from, where did you get the stories in the second parts of the book, the cases of practice?
Well, part of the study included doing, so we did surveyed students at the beginning and end of their courses, and then we also observed classes in which young people were learning how to discuss. We interviewed 250 students at the end of their courses, and so all of that qualitative data allowed us to write the case studies that are presented in the book and to think about how students are responding to their teachers' practice, how teachers are thinking about their own practices, and sort of what ethical challenges come up as a result.
And then the third portion of the book, Professional Judgment, as I said before, this is really a hornet's nest if it's not done properly.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we learned is that teachers encounter a number of ethical challenges when doing this kind of teaching. So one challenge is whether or not they should share their own political views when their students are discussing a controversial political issue. Another challenge is that there's a controversy about what's a matter of legitimate controversy. So how to define what's really an issue that belongs in the classroom is something that is, you know, really quite challenging for a lot of teachers. And what we were interested in was getting a sense of, well, how do teachers deal with these challenges? And are there things that teachers should always do, or should there be different approaches? And in a nutshell, what we found was that teachers needed to exercise professional judgment, and that in some cases it was good, for example, to disclose their own political views, and in some cases it wasn't so good. So we ended up saying, you know, it's not like there are hard and fast rules that teachers can follow with respect to these ethical questions, that instead they need to really look at a variety of different things and come to a good professional judgment. So one of the things that Paul and I are doing with teachers now is trying to engage them in deliberations of these ethical challenges and trying to get them to help come to a good understanding of what their own practice is going to be like.
Are there any topics that would just be completely off limits? And should there be any?
This is a question that a lot of teachers struggle with. Are there some issues that are sort of too hot to bring into the classroom or might be too offensive to some students? For the most part, we tend to side with the view that it's worse to avoid controversial issues than it is to bring them into the classroom. That said, teachers need a lot of skill and knowledge in making those conversations go well. We also point out in the book that some things that should not be introduced to students as controversial issues are closed empirical questions. So we make a distinction between open policy questions and questions that are settled empirically. So climate change is one, for example, that some teachers think, well, I should teach the controversy when there is, in fact, no real controversy among scientists. So we make the case in the book that if it's a settled empirical question, you don't introduce that to students as something for them to decide.
On the other hand, just to piggyback on that, there are lots of policy questions about climate change that we think are absolutely appropriate to include in the classroom. So one thing that we want teachers to think about is what's the difference between a question that really is open politically in society versus a question that is, as Paul suggested, more settled empirically. And this is really challenging because, you know, with climate change as an example, you might have parents in the community who don't believe climate change is a settled question. They do, in fact, believe that scientists are actually debating whether or not the climate is changing or whether or not it's caused in part by human behavior. So it can be really difficult for teachers to deal with teaching a settled empirical issue as a settled empirical issue. Just as an aside, there's new national science standards that have been developed, not by the federal government, but by a consortium of science educators. And in those new national science standards that are called the Generation Next Science Standards, both climate change and evolution are presented as settled empirical issues that should be treated as such. So we think it's an important distinction to make between what's a controversial political issue that's open in terms of what should we do, for example, about climate change, and what's a more settled question like, is climate change actually occurring?
Well, actually, you just helped me segue right into my next question, which is your audience makes the difference, too, because you mentioned evolution. If you're teaching at a Christian school, that's a totally different thing.
Right. These scientific questions have really become particularly sticky and partisan, actually. We've learned on climate change, for example, that conservatives who attend college are actually become more resistant to believing the climate change evidence than conservatives who haven't attended college, which suggests that the issue itself is just becoming a wedge issue or a polarized issue. And this makes bringing controversial issues into the classroom particularly tricky. And you're right also that context matters. So if parents have chosen a Christian school because they want a particular view of science taught to their children, this is an unfortunate consequence of, you know, for democracy, if parents are allowed to make these choices and or opt their children out of different curricula that they don't agree with.
Are there benefits to a student if they go to a school that is politically like-minded to them and their families?
Well, this is one of our really interesting and, in my view, challenging and not very positive findings, that there are some schools that we called like-minded schools, and those are schools in which 80% of the students in the classes had the same political views on these controversial political issues. And those schools tend to be housed in very homogenous political climates. So you can imagine, for example, a school that is in a precinct that went overwhelmingly, let's say 90% for Obama in 2008. That school is more likely to be a very homogenous or like-minded school. On the other side, we had a number of Christian schools that were very politically homogenous, but their students were more conservative. And what we found is that students in those classes were more likely to be politically active once they left high school. And so like-mindedness predicts political participation. Now, political scientists find this with adults as well. Adults who are in highly partisan communities are more likely to be partisans themselves, and partisans are more likely to engage politically. Now, there's nothing wrong necessarily with being partisan, but what is troubling is we know that a lot of partisans are very resistant to listening to alternative points of view. And so what we found in these like-minded classrooms is that the teachers who were doing, in our minds, really good work had to work very, very hard to make sure that students were hearing multiple and alternative points of view. And they did that sometimes by bringing in guest speakers who had a different point of view or by taking their kids to forums and summits where they were encountering kids from different communities, or by bringing in materials from some of these democratic education organizations that had multiple and competing views. So what we found is that teachers in these like-minded classrooms didn't see this as a deliberative asset necessarily. They saw it as a problem that they had to reckon with. And when they were doing a good job, they really did reckon with it in very, very serious ways. We recount one story in the book where in a very, very blue classroom, the teacher brought in a guest speaker who had a view on abortion that was quite different, the opposite of the view that most of the kids had. And the students initially were kind of resistant to this, but later when we interviewed them after they had graduated from high school, they looked back on this and said, it was so good that our teacher, Mr. Kushner, did that, because that got us realizing that it's really important to understand alternative perspectives, even if those are not the perspectives that we hold.
Still to come, our conversation with Diana Hess and Paula McAvoy, authors of The Political Classroom, continues with a look at the skills students need to make this work. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1270. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. We're talking about civics education and discussing political issues in the classroom. Our guests are Dr. Diana Hess and Dr. Paula McAvoy, authors of the new book, The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. We've been talking about the skills of the teachers. What about the skills of the students? How old do they need to be before they can really discuss these things?
We think about the skills of discussion as something that teachers ought to explicitly teach, much like the skills of writing, for example. So we saw in the study we had students as young as 9th grade and through 12th grade. So this was a study of high school teachers. But certainly we know that there are middle schools and upper elementary schools teachers that who do a good job of preparing young people for discussion. And the way you do it is really be explicit about what it means to discuss and how to share a point of view, how to respond to someone else's point of view, and preparing students, as Diana just said, with materials that give them multiple and competing views so that they can first formulate an opinion and then come to a discussion ready with some information and views. So teachers that do this well make the skills of discussion part of the curriculum of the class.
Well, one thing I wanted to add is that one of the challenges for teachers is that some students come in already very skillful at discussing political issues because they've learned it at home or they've learned it someplace else, and other students come in without those skills. So it's not like everybody is at the same starting place. And unfortunately, one of the things we know is that the social class of the student predicts how skilled they are. And so teachers need to make sure that they don't just speak with kids who already come in with these skills because they've had a more privileged background. And the teachers who are really good at this recognize this. And they don't think that talking is something that you're born with. They think talking, as Paula suggested, is something like writing that you can be taught. And so what we found in these classrooms where teachers were really doing a good job is they didn't accept kids who said, well, I just don't like to talk. Instead, what they did is they taught those kids how to talk. They believed that it was really a critical skill. And it was a critical skill not just for learning, because we literally talk ourselves to understanding, but it was a critical skill for democracy. So most of the teachers we interviewed believed that they were really doing very important work, not only for the students in terms of their academic skills, but for society as a whole.
So it's important for a teacher to challenge that person hiding in the back of the row.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, let's take a look ahead. Do you see this becoming more prevalent, less prevalent? I mean, we certainly can't say that the political atmosphere is getting any less polarized these days. So is that going to move over to the classroom, too? And are most teachers just going to think, you know what, I don't want to deal with this?
We hope not. And there are some things to suggest that there could be change in the classroom. So the Common Core standards, actually the language arts standards, have an emphasis on argumentation and using evidence. And discussion is one great way to develop those skills. And so there's likely to be more discussion in classrooms as the Common Core, if the Common Core takes hold. We also think that, you know, discussion is a great academic skill overall. And what we found in the study is that it's a highly engaging activity for young people. And so we hope that schools of education and teachers think more about how to prepare teachers to do this well, because what we know from the students is that it's highly engaging and it has certain democratic outcomes that are important, especially today.
And that being said, one of the things that I think is important is that we do know that the political climate is not becoming less polarized or less partisan. And so I think what needs to happen is that the public and parents especially need to demand of the schools that students be taught how to do this. And, you know, it's hard to demand of schools that your child be taught in an environment where they're going to hear views that are different than your own. It seems kind of oxymoronic, right? We often want schools to reflect our own political views, but we shouldn't. Regardless of whether we're progressive or conservative, we should want schools to be places where students are hearing multiple and competing views. And so what Paul and I think is going to happen is that this is one of those things that schools will be responsive to if the public and parents demand it. And one of the reasons we're so interested in talking to the public on programs like this is we want people to see this as something that should be the meat and potatoes of what is going on in their schools. And people need to be asking their schools, are you teaching young people how to learn about and talk about the important political issues of the day? And if you're not, you need to be.
Dr. Diana Haas is a professor of curriculum and instruction at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and senior vice president of the Spencer Foundation. And Dr. Paula McAvoy is a philosopher of education and assistant program officer of the Spencer Foundation. The name of their book is The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. The President and Congress have been at odds lately because of Mr. Obama's presidential executive orders on immigration and other matters. And guess what? That's a pretty old story. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Recently, the use of executive orders by the President has become a hot political discussion. I am Dr. Lynn Pascarella, President of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Shirley Ann Warshaw, professor of political science at Gettysburg College, discusses the nature of their use.
One of my scholarly interests is analyzing the continuing battles between Congress and the President over the limits of the President's commander-in-chief authority. The tension between the branches has significantly increased in recent decades, regardless of which party controls Congress or the White House. President Obama and Congress wrestled over the prisoner exchange at Guantanamo Bay, for example, which had less to do with the prisoners or the future of the prison than with the limits of the president's commander-in-chief authority. When members of both houses loudly complained that President Obama had violated the 30-day notice that the law required before any prisoner release or exchange from Guantanamo Bay, the president reacted by reminding them that he had vigorously objected to the requirement. In fact, when he signed the law, he said that Congress could not hinder the executive's ability to carry out its military, national security, and foreign relations activities. Year after year, Congress has tried to limit the president's role as commander-in-chief, and routinely those efforts have fallen on deaf ears. The issue is institutional, not partisan. During the Bush administration, a Republican-controlled Congress banned torture. But President George W. Bush ignored the ban, arguing that Congress had no constitutional authority to become involved with how the military conducts its operations. Both Republicans and Democrats have aggressively asserted that Congress cannot pass laws that limit a president's authority as commander-in-chief or in national security decisions. This tug of war between the branches over the limits of the president's commander-in-chief authority will unquestionably continue and will escalate, regardless of which party controls Congress or controls the White House. Partisan divides often heighten the debate, but the institutional underpinnings drive the debate.
That was Shirley Ann Warshaw of Gettysburg College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.